Hey friends, welcome back to the show. I'm Dr. Nick Wilson. This is the Max Living Podcast. Hey friends, we've got a special episode for you today. I sit down with Dr. Larry Pilevsky. He's a licensed pediatrician. He's become more of a friend over the past few weeks. And man, we just had a really good conversation about fevers, about the innate capacity to heal, how to take care of our children. And I know you're going to love this episode with Dr. Larry Pilevsky. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So as we were talking earlier, I mentioned the word natural pediatrician, and you said, hey, let's not call me a natural pediatrician. Talk to me about that. Like, what is that? Why not natural pediatrician? Because you practice very differently than mainstream medical pediatrician from what I've known about you.
Right. Well, you know, people call me a holistic pediatrician, an alternative pediatrician, a holistic integrative pediatrician. I'm a pediatrician. I base my practice, the way I act in the office, on the material that I was taught when I was in medical school and residency, which was take a good history, do a full physical exam, listen to the parents, they know their kids, especially the mother, and then make clinical diagnoses and treatments based on the history and the physical. I mean, we were taught that 95% of our answers to what's going on with a child should come from a good history and a good physical. And labs and studies are all maybe 5%. And so that's the way I was trained, and that's the way I practice. Good clinical applied medicine. And that's what pediatrics was before the 1990s came around, when predominantly everything was done based on protocols. So if a kid had a headache, you went down a protocol. This is what you do. If a kid had a fever, you went down a protocol. This is what you do. It was no longer based on the individual kid and the individual family. It was now based on the symptom and what you should do to treat the symptom. And we weren't treating kids anymore. I was taught to treat kids. I was taught to treat kids in the context of a family, in the context of a kid's history, in the context of a physical exam. How many times when I see kids today being taken care of by pediatricians, and then they'll come to my office, parents will say to me, oh no, the pediatrician barely examined my kid. I said, well, how did the diagnosis get made? Oh, I just told the pediatrician what was wrong and just very scantily examined the kid and then gave me a prescription for antibiotics. Mm. And so that's not pediatrics. That's protocol medicine. That's follow the symptom, treat that way. And that's not the way I was trained. Mm-hmm. I was trained by pediatricians who practiced in New York City from the 1940s all the way up to the 1980s, mm-hmm. some even into the 1990s. And that's all they had. They had history, they had physical, they had feel. They had the senses. They had smell, taste, listening, their eyes, their vision, and their feel, and then their intuition. And since the mid-90s, that has been kicked out of medical education. And what I'm noticing is that a lot of the young doctors barely know how to do a good history and a good physical. And they just do a symptom, here's a prescription, you're out of the office. So that's not pediatric medicine to me.
Well, I've not heard that term protocol medicine, and I think it's appropriate. I'm probably going to adopt that protocol medicine. Has that been hard to go a different direction than, and have you come under attack or under fire for going in a different direction than, say, protocol medicine?
Well, I didn't go in a different direction. I kept going in the direction that I was trained in. Mm. I mean, if anything, everyone else went off in a different direction, because I was trained to practice clinical pediatric medicine. Mm. Take a good history, look at the body, look at the mind, look at the spirit, look at every aspect of what incorporates, what contributes to the being of the child, and try to understand what are the root causes and come up with an answer as to how to best help the child. You know, I'll never forget in the mid-90s, when I was already an attending on a pediatric ward, I had a medical student introduce a patient that was admitted the night before to On Rounds, and she said, well, a five-year-old came into the emergency room with a headache, and the MRI showed. And I stopped her, and I said, excuse me, can you tell me more about the headache? And so I went through a litany of questions. Was there any trauma? Did the headache, was the headache worse in the front of the head, the back of the head, the side of the head? What brought the headache on? What made the headache go away? Did it wake the kid from sleep? Does the headache happen after the kid eats? Does the headache happen when the kid wakes up in the morning? Any associated vomiting with it? Is there any visual problems with it? Any imbalanced issues? Did the child come from a family that there was a death? Was there a divorce? Was a new baby born? Right? Was the child added to a new school? All right, what's the child's sleep pattern? What's the child's diet? Any new foods? I mean, I kept going on, and the medical student looked at me like, what? I just want to tell you about the MRI.
Because that's not how she was trained?
No. Wow. She wasn't trained. And this was in the mid-90s, 95, 96. And I got in trouble
why did you get in trouble?
Because I was grilling the medical students to learn how to practice pediatric medicine. Mm. The residency director of the hospital where I was working actually yelled at me because I was grilling the medical students too strongly. Mm. In other words, we're doing protocol medicine. Leave it alone and stop grilling the medical students and residents. Like, why would you go to the MRI when you could actually understand what might be going on with the kid if you did a good history? And then in the physical, did the child have any balance issues, right? Was the child walking straight, right? Was the child groggy? Mm-hmm. How'd the child hold the head, mm-hmm. right? None of this was possible in my evaluation, my teaching of the medical student. We just needed to get to the MRI and finish it off.
Mm. It's gotta be disheartening for you.
Well, it was disheartening to me if I stayed in that place of teaching. But I just went on and eventually became a private practitioner, having my own practice.
Sure.
So I still did inpatient pediatrics. I still covered the intensive care unit, the neonatal intensive care unit, you know, high-risk deliveries in the hospital, and then any high-risk patients in the ER. But I just taught where people were interested rather than, you know, just overall teaching of all the medical students and residents. If any of them were interested, they'd come up to me and ask me privately. Otherwise, I just, you know.
Did you get a lot of interest of people who did?
Some, not a lot.
Interesting.
Some, I think many of them found it boring, because they were already starting to be trained symptom, treatment, protocol, mm-hmm. protocol. And they weren't really interested in the finesse of how to ask the right questions. And that's the thing that I was trained with only 10 years previously. I was trained to ask the right questions and keep asking questions so that you can figure out the puzzle. That's what it was. It was a puzzle. And they weren't interested in the puzzle. They were just interested in the symptom, what test, what's the answer, what's the treatment, let's go on. And I thought, oh, wow, that's not medicine at all. I mean, that's like saying I'm a chef because I can open up a cookbook and follow a recipe. And that, now you're a chef. Well, great, good for you. Do you have any training in being? No, I just follow the recipes in the book. Oh. So there's no finesse in your meal preps. No, why should I? I just follow the recipes in the book. Mm-hmm. And that's what it became. And I have no interest in that, because that's not medicine to me.
There's a certain artistry to it. There's a philosophy. In chiropractic, as you know, we say it's a philosophy, it's a science, but it's also an art, mm-hmm. right? What I hear you saying is protocol medicine, kind of taking the art out of it,
right.
or that clinical judgment, that skill out of it. Now, have you then come under fire here as of late for practicing differently, especially in this world where we are increasing the number of doses of vaccines and we are this seems like the medical model has continued to move in that same direction of protocol medicine.
Yeah, but the demand for the kind of medicine that I practice is only increasing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going against anything. Mm-hmm. I'm going in favor of how I was trained, which was critical thinking, ask questions, challenge, and dare to challenge, and be willing to learn something new. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you can't learn anything new if you're not asking questions. Mm-hmm. Right? So every square peg goes into a round hole if you're following protocol medicine. Like, you know, every kid who has a fever gets whatever treatments the Western medical system, you know, offers. But if you look at chiropractic or naturopathy or homeopathy or herbology, you might have different remedies for fever. And in fact, you might have different responses to the remedies, right? Some kids who get chiropractic treatment, their fever may disappear. Other kids may get chiropractic treatment and their fever spikes. And both of them are perfect, right? Because you're just opening the body to the place where the body does what it needs to do to complete whatever process is going on. And that's medicine, mm-hmm. right?
Well, talk to me about that. So as in your line, you know, you work with chiropractors and you've taught chiropractors over the years mm-hmm. and worked alongside them, and you tell patients or you've told patients to see chiropractors.
Right.
Talk to me about that. Why does a child in your mind, why would a child benefit from a chiropractic adjustment? And then as a follow-up, why would a fever go up or down? Why would a parent be confident in either scenario?
So in about 1994, I was working as an ER physician in New York, in the Bronx, and I was doing pediatric emergency medicine. One of the nurses was watching some of my questions and said to me, "I have an acupuncturist you'd really like." I said, "I don't know anything about acupuncture. What's that?" She said, Go see her. So I went to see her, and then she said, "You know, I have a friend who's a chiropractor who you might be interested in like chiropractic. I don't know anything about that." But I was curious. You know, I didn't know everything. I was in my 30s, early to mid-30s. And I thought, all right, I'll go. And the chiropractor who started to treat me told me that the body has the innate capacity to heal.
Was this foreign to you at this point?
Oh, well, I didn't know what the hell that meant.
Okay.
The body has the innate capacity to heal. You know, where is that in any of my 4 years of medical school and 4 years of residency and fellowship? Not anywhere. So I asked, what does that mean? And she told me, body has the innate capacity to heal. And I listened because I wanted to know more. It wasn't something that was familiar to me, but just because it wasn't familiar to me doesn't mean it's wrong.
Sure.
Right? So I was curious and I just kept going. And over the years, I started to understand what chiropractors can do. You know, not every medical doctor is good. Well, not every chiropractor is good. Mm-hmm. So I started to find those chiropractors that had the touch and the adjustment that I thought was appropriate for the children in my practice. Mm-hmm. And so as I started to learn that the nervous system is a shock absorber and how much the nervous system or how much the balance of the nervous system, like the balance of the autonomic systems, the parasympathetic and sympathetic, are flexible and malleable, I started to realize how much the nervous system is like a shock absorber.
Explain that. What do you mean by a shock absorber?
Well, the body receives information all the time. Comes through the air, comes through the mouth, comes on the skin, comes at the nervous system, and gets pushed in through injection. And so the body has to reel from things that are offensive. You know, not everything we put in is pure. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to discern what's, you know, healthy for the body and pure and what's not healthy. And that requires a defense. That requires the body's ability to hear, see, taste, feel, and understand what's coming in and discern and decipher. Mm. And sometimes if there's an overwhelm in the nervous system gets thrown back, right? It's no different than, you know, punching a wall with a little bit of energy and then punching a wall with a lot of energy, right? You may not break your hand with a little energy, but you might break your hand with a lot of energy. And so the body has just so much flexibility and resilience mm-hmm. to take on all that's coming at it. And sometimes it's all at once. And so that nervous system needs to be flexible. It needs to be malleable. It needs to have bounce so that when, just like when you're driving a car, if you don't have good shocks, you hit a pothole, you might lose your axle, mm. right? But if you have good shocks and you hit a pothole, you might just bounce and keep going, right? And so the goal I started to see that chiropractic could offer children would be the ability to maintain the nervous system in that flexibility, in that malleability. And so we know how intricately the nervous system is involved with the immune system, and the immune system with the nervous system, mm-hmm. and the gastrointestinal system with the nervous system, and the nervous system with the gastrointestinal system, mm-hmm. and the nervous system with the pulmonary system, and the pulmonary system with the nervous system. And every system is involved intricately with the nervous system. So what I started to see was that what chiropractors could do was not treat conditions, but give children's nervous systems the ability to be flexible enough and malleable enough to handle whatever onslaught was coming in a greater fashion, in a healthier fashion, in a more optimal fashion, right? So cerebral spinal fluid would flow more easily. And so obstructions could be released and the body would do the rest. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I saw the value in chiropractic and cranial sacral therapy. And then I started to, you know, speak to osteopaths who did similar work in, you know, I know chiropractors and osteopaths don't always, you know, agree.
We get along great.
Okay.
Work together
well, good.
Just fine.
Oh, great. So I just started to see the value in giving the structure and function more of a chance to absorb and be flexible and deal with whatever physiological factors were going on. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard when you have a nervous system that's taut, when you're trying to make changes in diet and emotional environment.
And that tautness on the spinal cord itself sure. is what you're talking about, yeah. that tautness on the spinal cord.
Vagus nerve, the spinal cord, right. I mean, the vagus nerve is the biggest nerve coming out of the head. It supplies every part of the body except for the adrenal glands. So it's important.
And there's various ways that and reasons why there'd be tension or tautness on the spinal cord
sure.
and the vagus nerve.
Birth trauma, difficult pregnancy, right? The way the baby sleeps, injections, right? Any kind of trauma to the baby during infancy, falls, mm-hmm. right? Those are things that, you know, stiffen the body and you want malleability, you want flexibility because that will allow for the baby to handle his or her environment more optimally. And so when a child has a fever, right, and the child goes to a chiropractor and the fever goes away, you know, the parent thinks, wow, chiropractor made the fever go away. And the chiropractor didn't make the fever go away. The chiropractor gave the child's physiology a chance to do what it's supposed to do. It made the fever go away, but the chiropractor didn't make the fever go away.
Yes, I love this. Keep going.
then you have another child who goes to the chiropractor, and the fever goes way up, right?
Did the chiropractor make that happen?
No. As I understand it, the child's fever was working as it should to burn off whatever inflammatory process is going on, and often the fever is doing what it could do, but you know the body has to have oomph to kick out whatever inflammatory process is going on. And in my view, a fever is not necessarily infection. That's how I was taught when I was a medical student resident. Nowadays, a fever is almost always an infection. And so you hear parents, you hear medical doctors all saying, oh, the fever is an infection, when it's not. Right? The body can mount a fever because there are inflammatory materials that are built up either acutely or over time. And so if the body has to get rid of those inflammatory materials, it's going to burn a fever. Mm. But if the fire's not hot enough, it's going to linger. It might take a little bit longer, right? So if a chiropractic adjustment helps the fever go way up, then what the adjustment did was open up the body's capacity to do the burning up that needs to be done. And oftentimes, those fevers are much more short-lived. They'll go higher, but then they'll disappear quicker because the body's ability to fulfill removal of the wastes mm-hmm. is increased by the chiropractic adjustment, and that's why the fever went up. But the chiropractor didn't make the fever go up. The chiropractor gave the child's body the ability to mount the oomph that the child needed to burn the rest of the crap out. Mm. And usually that lasts a shorter period of time and goes away pretty quickly.
I know how many, you don't know how many times that being with a patient, fever goes up after an adjustment, and there's still that a little bit of that freak out mode.
Sure.
With everyone involved, mm-hmm. right? Including like the chiropractor, because mm-hmm. it's like, all right, what is this? Because you just don't know, but you see it enough times, then you realize, oh, I know pretty much what's going to happen here. But I wonder just how much damage we're doing by trying to chase and reduce the fever.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? How much damage are we doing long-term by doing that?
Well, I detest fever suppressants in general. That doesn't mean we don't do something to help make the child feel more comfortable. But one has to remember that the body temperature is generally about 98.6. The chemicals that keep the body at 98.6 are the same chemicals that give the body 102.
Talk to me about that. What do you mean?
So people think that if you don't have a fever, the chemicals that give you the fever aren't around. Mm. Well, that's wrong. Because if it's 70 degrees outside and your body temperature is 98.6, your body is working a little bit to keep it at 98.6. So the chemicals that cause your body to stay at 98.6 are still circulating. They're just not circulating in large quantities where you'll feel it.
Got it.
Right? If your body temperature is 98.6 and it's 40 degrees out, you might feel your body work a little bit harder to stay at 98.6 because you'll shiver. Mm-hmm. And that's the way your body raises your body temperature. And then you'll start to feel the chemicals that are trying to keep you at 98.6. Mm-hmm. All those cytokines, interleukins, tumor necrosis factors, interleukins, those are all present at 98.6. Because we're constantly bringing material into our body that produce inflammation or wastes. Mm-hmm. So you need those chemicals, mm-hmm. right? The only reason those chemicals may go higher is because you have more wastes that have come into your body.
In the form of toxicity or in the form
of... Well, I hate using the word toxins. I prefer to use the materials that enter the body, right? Because we know not everything that enters the body is pure. Right, so the air we breathe, that's one entry point. The foods or the materials we eat, because people choose to eat non-foods
right.
that are sold as foods, but they're not, right? So those will produce wastes. The materials we put on our skin get absorbed into the body, and if they're not the purest, they will cause inflammation because of wastes. Mm-hmm. The information we pull in from the nervous system, so in our senses, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our mouths, our touch, our feel, electromagnetic fields, toxic people. That's where I'll use the word toxic.
Toxic people.
Toxic people, right? And then the last way of information's put into the body is through injection, mm-hmm. right? So the body has to mount a response to one or more of those materials that are coming in on a pretty frequent basis. Now, if we're balanced, if we're flexible, if our nervous systems are malleable, if our exit points are pretty open, right, then we won't feel the effects of those waste products. We won't. We also won't feel the effects of the waste products that our body produced by utilizing the pure materials that came in through those entry points. But if we have a greater load of that material that comes in, it's going to make the immune system mount an immune response against it. And that's going to produce more of those chemicals. Mm-hmm. And if you've gone past the threshold by which your body can handle it, you'll have a fever. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of the fever is to augment natural body function. Mm-hmm. And it's not because necessarily you caught a bug. I mean, if it were true that you had a fever because you caught a bug, we'd be pretty sick all the time because our bodies have hundreds of trillions of bugs in them. So it makes no sense to think that it's just a bug or an infection. It's more in line with an understanding that it's really about a threshold of how much your body can take in before you produce enough inflammatory materials that you're going to raise the level of cytokines and interleukins and, you know, tumor necrosis factor and neurotransmitters and prostaglandins and leukotrienes and all complement factors and all those chemicals that will raise the body temperature so that your body will stop the load of waste. The one thing that's most fascinating if we look at the ologies of the body is the body does everything it can to not die until it's ready to die. So
it's always adapting, always trying to fight towards balance and homeostasis.
Correct.
And equilibrium.
Right. And if there's too much of a load coming in, the body's going to say, okay, no more. Mm-hmm. No more. And we're going to shut you down. So you're going to feel like crap because we're not going to let this body keep adding more stress because we got to get rid of what we've put in because what we've put in has reached capacity to what we can handle. So we need to mount that furnace because we're just augmenting what we're doing on a day-to-day basis when we don't feel it anyway, because we don't feel it because we're hopefully in a greater balance.
Mm-hmm. So for a parent right now, and I just had a conversation with a group of actually chiropractors, their friends, and we were just sitting around this round table having this discussion of everything you're talking about. Actually, you were brought up when we were talking about it, that the fever, the exposure, that all of these things then would allow the body to heat up and do the right thing. Rather, that these exposures then allow the body to heat up instead of suppressing it, that it's doing the right thing at the right time. But one of the things that was brought up and a question that was brought up to challenge that was, well, okay, how about the chicken pox? We're exposed to the chicken pox or whatever, and our kids definitely get it, and it was exposure to something. How do you explain something like the chicken pox where it was an exposure to, and then the symptoms then were then created afterwards? Was there still a level of toxicity, or how do you say it? Not toxicity, but that burden on the body because of the materials that were there? Is there a disconnect there, or does that still fit? Does chicken pox fit in to what we're talking about?
In one model, yes. In another model, maybe not. And so the idea to understand is that children need to go through certain febrile illnesses as rites of passage. And if you look in Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, you'll see that many of the childhood illnesses used to be based on an understanding of removal of fetal toxins. Children are always pruning. Mm-hmm. They're always pruning. They're born with more brain cells than they need. There's genetic material that needs to be pruned from mom and dad. Everything needs pruning. As tracts are being laid down, as immune systems are building. And so the childhood illnesses predominantly used to come late winter, early spring. Now that makes sense in the animal kingdom. If you watch, what do animals do late winter, early spring when they come out of winter? They shed their skin, they detox. So it was understood that many of these childhood illnesses were attempts from nature to augment the body's capacity to prune, remove wastes, and advance the immune system and the nervous system of the growing child who came in with a lot more junk than we gave our understanding to. And so, and then children, you know, what they're fed early and whatnot. So the goal was to allow these illnesses to happen. And then if you look on the other side, you'll see that, you know, children who had the measles had lower incidences of cancer, or chickenpox, lower incidences of cancer. And then you start looking into some of the literature, and they're using the measles virus to cure cancer, and they're using the polio virus to cure cancer. And it makes you step back and say to yourself, well, were these illnesses for the purpose of preventing the more chronic, serious illnesses going down the line? Because it goes back to what my mentors taught us, even though they didn't know Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine. What they said was they would see their children in their practice have their measles, mumps, chickenpox, rubella, flu illnesses, and then they would see the children have developmental growth spurts after the illnesses were over, when they were unimpeded. Well, that's no different than pruning. That's no different than detoxing. That's no different than getting rid of fetal toxins. That's no different than rites of passage. That's no different than strengthening your immune system to keep you healthy as you move through life. So it's all there. It's just a matter of, you know, our preferences to ignore because of our fears and, you know, what the media tell us and what the protocols now tell us. There are so many safe ways to have chickenpox, measles, mumps, rubella, flu. So many safe ways. And in my over 20 years of seeing kids where the families didn't give their children these injections, the children, all the parents saw the children had developmental growth spurts after they would have those illnesses. So they saw it firsthand. It wasn't just my teaching. It was their teaching. Wow, my kid got up and walked. Wow, my kid started talking. Wow, my kid just seemed calmer.
And that right there gives you so much courage and confidence and a level of boldness for the next child or for the next time it happens.
Sure, sure. And nobody knows what measles even looks like anymore. Or chickenpox even looks like.
Isn't that hard? Because as you're describing it as being in a genetic upgrade, it was what I kind of hear you saying.
Somewhat.
And are we robbing our next generation of certain levels of genetic pruning or genetic upgrades?
Two generations have already been robbed.
It's hard to think about that, isn't it?
Right. And so then I get the question, Dr. Nick, hey, well, my child went through childhood without having chickenpox or measles. What does that mean for his or her immune system? That's a good question. You know, pruning can still happen without those infections, but that's a good question as to what does it mean if they don't go through those illnesses?
Sure. Well, this has been such a great conversation. And I think this will be part one of further discussions, maybe in the future. And I really hope, candidly, that, you know, you and I work alongside Max Living for the future of our kids to develop better systems together. So yeah. I'm really looking forward to that. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you for inviting me.